moisture from the shadow of the armored car. I know. I know. Now. I attempted to struggle onto my feet, but slumped on the edge of the armored car and just sat there, my breath short. I tried to focus my eyes and looked out across the desert at the cactus and the acacia and suddenly remembered the canteen. I swung it around slowly and unscrewed the top, gulped a few mouthfuls of the warm water, and then carefully screwed the top back on. With a deep sigh, I edged off the metal lip and stood, adjusting the straps of both the rifle and canteen, and then taking a step, then another and another, until I'd made the road and started off southeast, farther and farther from home. I'm not sure when I became aware of the sun being behind me, but it was, drying the sweat that threatened to solidify me into a statue. I'd given up thinking about much of anything as I stumbled on, pretty sure that if I lessened my attention for even a second, I was likely to go crashing to the ground again, and unsure if I still had the energy to get back up. I wiped the sweat from my face and opened the canteen, but there was nothing there except the leathery dryness. The land had changed again, but the iron-colored mountains still trailed to my right. It was hard to judge how far I'd come. I was sure I'd been traveling most of the nightmarish day, my legs having turned into stilts that moved like a drawing compass, awkward and stiff. The landscape was a negative photograph of itself, the color washed away with nothing but the creosote phosphorescence flushed with heat. I watched the tail end of the mountains begin to peter out. I was sure I was as far south as the Orfanato, and cast my eyes around looking for it, but there was nothing. Maybe there was nothing as far as I could travel, and this was how it ended, alone in a desert. Maybe after all the walking, I was no closer to saving Katie than when I'd cleared the canyon rim at the beginning of this endless day. There was a low rumble behind me, like drums. I was in mid-stride when I felt a bit of a breeze. Turning just a little, I could see the cloud bank that had been building over the mountains, the edges of the clouds shining like platinum, and I could have sworn the temperature had dropped a good 10 degrees as more than a dozen dust devils widely pirouetted through the ironwood and cactus, the smell of the creosote like a tonic as I stood there wavering in the wind. The world darkened behind me, and with the wind at my back I turned toward the Cecil B. DeMille sky with a little more energy, like a light on the road to Damascus. The drums were still beating, and I could feel them pushing me forward. My boots took on a life of their own, each following the other, carrying me along with a low-flying wind. It was flat now, and the road was straight, and I'd found a juggernaut reserve that kept me stumbling forward, my shirt parachuting in front of me. A lashing skiff of rain sheeted across the desert, a gift from the heavens that cooled my skin and allowed some color to return to the world. It was enough to combat the smell of creosote, but not enough to sustain the land, so the desert lay back down and did what it has done since the beginning of time. It waited. I cleared my throat as best I could and stayed concentrated on the horizon in front of me, when I saw another body lying in the road. Saturated by the brief rain, the blue blouse and badge huddled in the center, unmoving. Every organ in my body flipped, and I found myself running toward her. I fell onto the road and pulled her to me. I held her head up and gently brushed the wet, matted hair away from her eyes to find the face of Bianca Martinez, whom he must have dressed in Katie's clothes. I hugged her to my chest and held her there, feeling relief that it wasn't Katie, but a deep sadness at the loss of such a friend. I held her tighter and suddenly realized that she wasn't cold. Pulling her back away from me, I looked and was even more shocked by her fluttering eyelids and the violet irises looking up at me. Her lips parted, and she expelled air from her lungs, saying a single word, "No." Pulling her in closer, I smiled as best I could, and croaked, You're going to be all right." I sounded like a mote of dust released from an ancient book. Her hand came up, brushing my arm. "No." "I promise, you'll be okay." "No." She looked away, and I was afraid I was losing her, so I started to scoop another hand under her legs in an attempt to lift her. "No, they..." I had just gotten her in my arms, and had begun to lift her when something struck me in the head from directly behind. I fell forward and lay across her, now trying to get my arms under me to push off from the caked red sand that stuck to my face. I heard her crying, but then another blow landed on my head, and I flopped forward and lay there because that was all I could do. Chapter 15. It was a slow process, like a log dislodged from the depths, rolling, tumbling, and finally surfacing, bobbing along in the current. Up from the blind depths, I felt myself rising through the levels of awareness until I was alive again. There was a hand on my face, and the fingers were cool. My eyelids fluttered, and I became aware of amethyst eyes looking down at me. I just lay there gazing into them. Seven Spanish angels. The eyes smiled.
What?
An old song. Well, there's only one of me. I tried to sit up, but collapsed back onto her lap. Katie.
She's alive.
I closed my eyes and just lay there breathing, grateful for small successes. Your brother? She said nothing, and I opened my eyes again to see if she had heard me, the streaks of tears telling me that she had. She looked away.
4 men it took. 4 armed men, and he fought them to a standstill, but they beat him senseless. He is up at the house with the women and children.
I glanced around in the mild darkness, taking in the collapsed stone wall and the rickety hayloft and even the manger where I'd found the AKs. The orfanato?
Sí.
Is there anyone else alive?
I don't know where the seer is.
All but the orphans, your daughter, Aiden, the housekeeper, and myself, are dead. Finally, summoning enough energy to rise up and support myself with one arm, I craned my neck in an attempt to exorcise some of the pain. Have you seen Isidro?
Who?
The sniper. She studied me with a strange look on her face.
Oh, right, you never saw him.
I tried to stand, but decided that could wait.
What happened?
Alonso's ridiculous car wouldn't start, so we took another that had the keys in it and almost made it to Torero before it ran out of petrol and they caught us. They got a message that you were going by way of the canyon, and Bidart's men were waiting when they came out ahead of you. How did they get there so fast?
A private plane.
Rubbing the back of my head, I grunted. Was Culpepper the one who brained me?
Yes.
How the hell did he get out of there?
Just lucky, I guess.
We both turned to look at the cocky man who was on the other side of the broken wall, half his face bandaged and my hat back on his head. He sauntered around the low end with my .45 Colt, Henry's knife, an old kerosene lantern, and a plastic grocery bag.
I gotta tell you, you are one tough son of a bitch.
Praise from Caesar.
Right, whatever that means.
He nodded, sat on the rail of the manger, and hung the hissing lamp on a bridle hook, the grocery bag at his boots. He pulled out his fixings from his shirt pocket where I could see the top of the sat phone. With a bandaged hand, he made a show of nonchalantly rolling a cigarette, licking and sealing the edge.
We thought you were dead about 4 times, but you just kept right on going, like the Energizer Bunny.
You were watching me?
Periodically.
Putting a lighter from his pocket that I recognized as Aiden's, he flipped it open and lit his acrid-smelling smoke.
I mean, we had to leave a trail for you.
I let that one pass for now.
How did you get out?
He touched the bandages that entirely covered one side of his face.
Well, now, it wasn't unscathed, if you know what I mean.
He took another toke and held the cigarette out, blowing on the embers and watching it glow in the twilight.
That was a hot time in the old town.
He glanced at me.
I told you, you should have killed me.
Boy, howdy. He smiled.
Climbed up about 100 yards down the wall, and then you threw that grenade and it touched off the sulfur along with the methane.
He gestured toward his face.
Caught some of the flash, and it burned off all the hair on one side of my head. But I got over and was able to run away before the whole damn mountain came crashing down. He pointed the cigarette at me. You did a number on the place. Cost a lot of money and product. And really pissed some people off.
Glad to hear it.
He smiled. Yeah, well, we'll see about that.
Where's my daughter?
She's safe.
He nodded his head toward Bianca.
We had to borrow her clothes just to stop you, you know? He puffed on the cigarette. I'll make you a deal. You tell me where that engine sniper is, and I'll show you your daughter.
I don't know where he is.
Some of the swagger left him as he glanced out into the darkness. But he's out there, I'm betting. Somewhere.
Culpepper pulled the .30-06 shells from his pocket.
Where did these come from?
I couldn't say, but then I guess you can't either.
He considered me for a long while. Okie dokie. Then I guess we got no deal.
He shrugged, dropping them back in his pocket.
Now, let's get back to business. Need to know how you're feeling.
Let me see my daughter.
You'll see her tomorrow.
He waved my request away.
Now, I repeat, how are you?
What do you care?
You're just going to kill us all anyway. Not my choice. El Jefe has plans for you come daybreak, and I need to assess if you're up to snuff.
Carefully dragging a leg underneath me, I ponderously stood, towering over him as he slowly aimed my gun at me.
Easy there, cowboy.
I felt like I was going to fall over or throw up, neither of which would likely intimidate the challenger. So I did as he said and just stood there.
So you two are back together? Like two peas in a pod.
He gestured with the barrel toward the grocery bag.
There's food and water in there for the both of you. And there'll be more in the morning, but in the meantime, I suggest you get some rest. You're going to need it.
He stood and walked out, his voice trailing behind him.
I've got some boys of my own here guarding you, and out there circling the perimeter. And they'll be looking for that little Apache prick, so if you hear some shooting tonight, that's probably them sending a little fucker off to the happy hunting ground.
He began whistling Patsy Cline as he strolled off.
Sweet dreams!
I limped toward the crumbling wall where he'd disappeared and could see two men standing by the corral. Beyond them, the moonlight was gleaming off the aluminum skin of a twin-engine Beechcraft. I was coming around to the thought that having my old Doolittle Raider boss, Lucian Connolly, on this trip might have not been such a bad idea. After a moment, I felt Bianca standing beside me.
I'm assuming you have a plan?
The food was good, but the water was better. We sat under the unforgiving light of the '30s kerosene lantern I'd just repumped, a less than romantic mood having settled in with the hiss, as we took stock of what our options were.
What do you think Bidart has planned?
Something dramatic. It's what he does. I finished munching on the tortillas and swallowed some more water, feeling a little better. I'm wondering where they've got everyone. There aren't that many places where they could have them. There's only the main house in this place, so unless they're on the plane out there...
Do you fly?
I entertained the thought for a nanosecond. I think we'd all be safer facing overarmed, psychotic drug dealers than climbing into a plane with me at the controls.
Then what?
I walked back to the manger where Culpepper had been sitting and flipped open the hidden drawer where I'd found the AKs I'd taken with us to the mountain. The space lay empty, the Zapata Estaba Aquí message in chalk mocking me.
Well, whatever we're going to do, we're going to have to do it unarmed.
What about your friend, the Indian with the rifle?
I shook my head. I honestly don't know where he is or if he's even out there. I limped back over to the wall. It's you and me. I turned to look at her. How many men does he have with him? She came over, joining me in watching the two men at the corral as they smoked and watched us back.
Maybe a half dozen?
There's not very many. With one or two out checking the area and with someone with the old woman and kids and Aiden and Katie in the ranch house, it's possible that they'll leave only one man to guard us through the night. I glanced down at her. What vehicles are there?
There's the SUV they took us in
at Torero, and then an old school bus that belongs to the orfanato.
Yep, well, I don't think that thing has run any time since Truman was a tyke.
I sighed and then thought about it, remembering what Aiden had said. Your brother, he said, they drove it every day into Torero. But I'll check the Escalade first. I doubt they left the keys in it, so unless I can get them off of someone, then we will take the bus and I'll disable the Cadillac. If they were to chase us with the Beechcraft, what are they going to do, bump us with the tires? You can't exactly break the windows out of those things and shoot at us, and if I have my way, I'll have something to shoot at them. In my experience, civilian aircraft don't respond well to incoming fire. Besides, you're worrying about disaster 147 before we even get to number one. I glanced at the two men, and her eyes followed mine as her fingers twined around my arm.
You're going out there?
Adjusting the lamp, I glanced at her. I think I just might. It was later, much later, and we'd turned the lantern way down in hopes of indicating to the guards that we were going to sleep and to let our eyes adjust to the dark. Crouched by the lowest end of the wall, I watched and decided that these two jaybirds obviously had more cigarettes to smoke and things to discuss than any other two men in Mexico. Bianca lay out of the way, gently breathing as she slept, and I was about to give up the ghost and get some sleep myself when one of the men said something about cigarillos before walking off toward the main house. Evidently, they had finally run out of cigarettes. There was a small area under the manger where the rocks had given way, and it was possible I could get out that way, but just as I started to move, the one guard who remained stepped to the side to look at us, and I feigned sleep. After a moment, I heard him crunching back across the roadway and turned to find Bianca looking at me and whispering, "Now?" I crawled toward the opening, pausing only once to look back at her. "Remember, 15 minutes." She glanced down at the pocket watch I'd given her and nodded, and I was off. Elbowing my way through the dirt and cobwebs, I came out in what would have been the old compost heap, which added an odoriferous quality to my already sartorial splendor. Dragging myself up near a rickety fence, I glanced around but could only see one light on somewhere in the ranch house. If I were to make a bet, I'd be willing to wager that Bedard, Culpepper, and maybe one or two of the others would be availing themselves of the comforts on the plane rather than the run-down cottage. The barn blocked the one guard from observing me, but I was now in plain view of the ranch house and could only hope anyone there was otherwise occupied. The first thing to do was see if we had any way of escape. I thought I'd check the SUV before the run-down bus, on the offhand chance someone had left the keys in it. Staying low, I moved across the road toward the far end of the corral, away from the guard and where the Cadillac sat. Moving around the hood of the black Escalade, I crept up the side to look in the window for the key and then realized the thing had keyless entry and start. There really wasn't any way to see if the keys were in the thing without opening the door and alerting the entire ranch. I couldn't even tell if it was locked without pulling one of the handles. Hell. Shaking my head, I moved toward the lawn ornament of a bus manufactured by Mercury in 1959, and found the bifold doors hanging loose, and the key with a bottle opener chain hanging in the switch. How many pumps and cranks would it take to get this piece of crap running, and then how long would it run? Double hell. I was going to have to commit, because there wasn't going to be any time to play musical vehicles when we were trying to get out of here. As much as I detested the thought, the safe move was to disable the Escalade and hoped the old bus would start. Pulling the key from the vehicle, I moved back over and used the pointed end of the opener to try and stab one of the Escalade's tires, but it would only go in so far. Giving up, I took off the cap and used the point to gently push in the valve, slowly letting the air out until the tire was pretty well flat. I wanted to flatten another, but I knew I was running out of time, that at any moment Bianca was about to start our planned distraction, and then all hell was likely to break loose. I moved toward the house and circled behind, taking up a post beside the steps that led from the back screen door. The kerosene or maybe propane light was on in the kitchen, and I could see a couple of men drinking cans of beer at a table with their feet up, the crushed remains of the evening celebration scattered across the floor. There was a door to the right, and I assumed that was where the women and children and Aiden and Katie were. Slipping past it, I worked my way across the back of the house to another window where Alicia, the solemn little girl whom I'd met here when we'd gotten the mules, was looking at me. I froze and slowly raised a finger to my lips. I looked at her and then the window sash. It was about then that she simply raised the thing up and leaned out to look at me. Alexia's broad face appeared beside the child's, and I held the finger to my lips again.
"Is Katie here?"
She shook her head.
"No, she is on the plane with the bad men."
I sighed, staring at them as more tiny, grubby faces joined us in the window. "What about Aiden?" She glanced behind her.
"He's on the floor. He is badly hurt. Let's try and get him to the window and I'll carry him."
She shrank away from my outstretched hands.
"The children!"
I glanced past the faces, searching the room behind them. "Where's the old woman?"
"They killed her, on the porch, with the children watching."
I stood there, shocked for a moment, and then lowered my forehead on the sill. "Lord have mercy." Alexia's voice was solid.
"Yes, with all the saints of heaven, he watches over us. We take the children with us, yes?"
Breathing the dust away from the sill, I suddenly felt tiny hands patting the back of my head and raised my face to look into Alicia's dark eyes. Feeling like the world had been pulled out from under my feet and certainly placed on my shoulders, I raised my arms, picked her up, and lifted the first of many through the window. The kids were actually better than the two of us at keeping quiet. Playing as if it were a game, they began scurrying across the open ground like church mice and carefully climbed aboard the old bus. I helped Alexia get the unconscious Aiden up the vehicle stairs and was about to turn when I heard someone yelling and looked over to see flames licking the rafters of the half-collapsed barn.
"Fuego! Fuego!"
Evidently, Bianca and the kerosene lantern had done the trick, and the entire barn was doing a pretty good job of lighting up the place for 100 yards around. I had two more passengers to pick up, so I told Alexia and the children to stay in the bus and to keep down away from the windows. Then I circled around the back where the first guard was running past toward the ranch house. Realizing an opportunity when I saw one, I threw a leaping body block into the much smaller man, crushing him into the sand and dirt, my weight squeezing every bit of air out of him as I grabbed what turned out to be the M16 carbine I'd been carrying. I swung the butt of the weapon and knocked his head sideways, like the return carriage on a typewriter. If he wasn't out cold, he was at least down for the count. I swung the M16, checked the magazine, and flipped it to auto. Things were starting to even up. Limping across the road, I saw Bianca racing for the vehicles and presumed she'd figure out it was the bus or nothing when she got there. Logic dictated that most of the men would head for the fire, but I knew Bedard would leave at least one to guard Katie, and I knew which one I hoped it would be. I trailed behind the corral and inched toward the plane, which still sat there, the interior lights flicking on as more than a few people scrambled out of the fuselage door down the abbreviated stairs. Just to add a little confusion, I screamed in my best Spanish accent, "Policia! Policia!" and then sprayed the sky with a few rounds just to reinforce the ruse. The two men running from the house threw themselves to the ground when I fired, and I drifted another series of rounds across the yard, stitching the terrain with small geysers of dirt and rock. Somebody else fired, but I was pretty sure the shots were coming from the other side of the ranch house, so I continued around the wide tail assembly and came up on the door. Slowly rising, I saw a man I didn't know on the other side, kneeling on something wrapped in a blanket. He was holding a strange-colored Glock 9mm and looking out the window. Ducking back down, I figured I'd try at least one trick to see if I could save my daughter the anguish of watching him get sprayed across the interior of the beechcraft. Standing just to the side of the door, I shouted inside, "Fuego! Fuego, amigo!" Evidently, he was only waiting for an excuse to vacate the plane, because he came barreling out with a 9mm held high and was met with all the force I could put into the butt end of the M16. He dropped, and if he had any nose left, I really couldn't see any evidence of it. Snatching his sidearm and stuffing it in my jeans, I raised the M16 up to a firing position, stepped on the stairs, and, checking to make sure there weren't any other gunmen on the plane, lodged myself in the doorway. I stood there for a few seconds, still not taking my weapon from him as he lay there on the floor unmoving, when I heard a small voice from somewhere inside, "Daddy?" Charging down the aisle, I swiveled my head in search of her, finally stopping at the row of seats where the gunman had been kneeling and where I could see a mop of reddish-blonde hair and a set of nickel-plated eyes peering up at me.
"Oh, God!"
She was crying, pushing off the seat and climbing up to me, as I grabbed hold of her with the firm intention of never letting her go again. "Are you all right?" She sobbed and nodded her head.
"Yes, yes, I'm fine. But wait,
we've got to get out of here." I scooped her up with one arm and checked each window before climbing down through the doorway, with the barrel of the automatic rifle leading the way. The gunman hadn't moved, and I stepped out and turned back to her, noticing for the first time that she was wearing Bianca's flamenco dress and was barefoot. "You don't have any shoes?" She swiped her fist to clear the tears, and her eyes glinted.
"Don't worry about it. You lead, and I'll follow."
Swinging down the fuselage and around the tail section, I could see that the barn was a full-blown inferno, the dry hay in the loft swirling flames into a massive bonfire with orange sparks carried away in the vortex of its own heat. "Come on." I half carried her across the roadway toward the vehicles, just as I saw some of the men moving back toward the house and another one running toward the front of the plane. "We haven't got much time." Cutting through the corral, we climbed the rails on the other side, and I ushered her toward the old bus. "Get in there with the others, but if I get this caddy going, everybody needs to pile in it post-haste, got it?" Glancing around at the moldering mode of mass transit, she sighed.
"You've got to be kidding."
Bianca reached down and took her arm,